Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, we have the latest from the presidential campaign trail, including the results of Super Tuesday and a threat issued by the Trump campaign. Here in East County, the county has announced it will hold an additional hearing on that controversial redistricting plan proposed by the Grossmont Union High School District. This time, the hearing will be in Alpine, thanks to an inquiry from East County Magazine. In Sacramento, a top aide to Governor Jerry Brown is under fire for corruption allegations involving conflicts of interest regarding her former employer, a utility corporation. An outbreak of mumps has been reported at a local university here in San Diego County, and we'll have the tales on today's show. On our Capitol Report, learn about action on resolutions in Congress aiming to hold ISIS and the Syrian regime responsible for war crimes committed against religious minorities and others. We'll also have some exciting news about a breakthrough in a potential cure for Alzheimer's. In El Cajon, police are searching for a silver car that struck and seriously injured a 12-year-old girl, and we'll have details on the vehicle caught on video fleeing the scene. From Public News Service today, we'll have more top national stories, including a congressional inquiry into the Flint, Michigan poisoned water crisis, allegations of Voting Rights Act violations in Texas, President Barack Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court, and the latest news on a post-traumatic stress treatment in veterans. On our bookshelf segment today, Raina Menashe will interview Rebecca Grant, author of Sticky Web of Vengeance, The Coach's Wife. She'll be talking about the hardships she went through after learning some shocking revelations about her husband's past and coming to terms with losing him to cancer and facing a bitter battle with his children. She'll also talk about how her troubles inspired her to become an activist seeking to help others. And finally, we'll have some tips from the county on how to make sure that your rain barrels aren't harboring any unwanted pests, mosquitoes that can carry tropical diseases such as West Nile virus. We'll have all these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is Miriam Raftery with the latest news from the presidential primary race. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and business mogul Donald Trump scored sweeping wins in the Super Tuesday primaries held this week in Florida, Illinois, Missouri, Ohio, and North Carolina. Clinton secured wins in all states, though Missouri and Illinois were neck and neck. Her wins mark a major setback for Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who must now secure victories by large margins in the remaining big states, including California, to revive his hopes of winning the Democratic nomination. On the Republican side, Trump won everywhere but Ohio, where Governor John Kasich picked up his first primary victory in his home state. Florida Senator Marco Rubio announced his withdrawal from the race after failing to win his home state of Florida. The night was also disappointing for Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who didn't place first in any state but did pick up substantial delegates. The road to the Republican nomination remains rocky. Trump strengthened his position and now has a clear shot at gaining the most popular votes on a majority of delegates, which ordinarily would secure the party's nomination. But party insiders are jockeying for ways to bar Trump from being the nominee, some fearing his inflammatory rhetoric and hate speech could negatively reflect on the GOP, while others fear Trump won't take a hard enough line position on social issues or other core Republican principles. The possibility of a brokered convention at which neither Trump nor Cruz emerges as the nominee remains. House Speaker Paul Ryan and former Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney are among the names being floated by party insiders, CNBC reports. In an interview with CNN, Trump said that his supporters would be outraged if he does not automatically get the nomination as the candidate with the most delegates, adding, "I think you would have riots."
This is Leon Thompson with an education report. In response to an East County Magazine inquiry asking why Alpine was excluded from a list of upcoming hearings on the Grossmont Union High School District's controversial redistricting proposal, the County Committee on School District Organization has announced it will hold an additional hearing in Alpine on April 4th at 6 p.m. at Joan McQueen Middle School. The county had previously scheduled 4 hearings in other locations to get public input on the Grossmont Union High School District's proposed shift to electing governing board trustees by districts. The Grossmont board majority has said that it must shift to trustee districts after receiving a letter from an attorney accusing the district of Voting Rights Act violations. The Voting Rights Act aims to protect minority voting blocs to assure fair representation, but critics contend that this redistricting plan amounts to gerrymandering, weakening some committees' representation, including Chaldean Americans and Alpine residents. For Alpine, the stakes are high. Alpine stands to lose its only advocate for an Alpine high school, Priscilla Schreiber, who would lose her seat under the plan approved by the GUHSD. Alpine would be represented by Jim Kelly, a vocal opponent of the Alpine High School, an issue currently in litigation that has also led to unification efforts in which Alpine parents are seeking to break away from the Grossmont District. The Grossmont board voted 4-1 to adopt a controversial map and seek a waiver of a public vote despite opposition from members of the public who spoke, some alleging gerrymandering to oust a dissenting board member and break up a vocal minority voting bloc. The first hearing conducted by the county was held March 17th in La Mesa. Other upcoming hearings will be held April 4th in Alpine, April 5th in Jamul, and April 11th in Lakeside. The public can testify at the meetings and also submit written comments up until April 7th. The county's committee will vote to approve or disapprove the county's request at its April 13th meeting.
This is Miriam Raftery with news about corruption allegations against a top aide to California's governor. The nonprofit group Consumer Watchdog has filed a complaint with the Fair Political Practices Commission contending that Governor Jerry Brown's top aide, Nancy McFadden, broke state law by owning up to $1 million in stock from her former employer, Pacific Gas and Electric, while using her official position for personal financial benefit by intervening to inflate the company's stock price. She also reportedly failed to disclose the timing of her PG&E stock sales. Emails produced by the Public Utilities Commission, or PUC, through Public Records Act requests show that former PG&E lobbyist Brian Cherry, who was fired by the utility in the wake of the San Bruno gas pipeline corruption scandal, and former PUC President Michael Peavy, who is currently under criminal investigation, tapped McFadden as the governor's representative to rescue plummeting PG&E stock. The emails finger McFadden as the arranger of the appointment of a pro-utility commissioner to the PUC that sent a reassuring signal to Wall Street and raised PG&E's stock value, including McFadden's stock holdings. Jamie Court, president of Consumer Watchdog, states in a press release, Ms. McFadden has a duty to prove she recused herself from PG&E decisions or she should resign. Public officials who hold hundreds of thousands of dollars in stock options in a utility that employed them need to create a clear record for their colleagues that they will not participate in decisions that affect the value of their stock, he said, adding, the governor's top aide sets the ethical tone for the entire administration. California law prohibits any public official from using his or her official position to influence a governmental decision in which the official has a known financial interest. McFadden was also the point person in the governor's office for all legislative matters, and she did not create a record of recusal on legislative or other matters related to PG&E, according to Governor Brown's response to a Public Records Act request filed by Consumer Watchdog. Mike Aguirre is a San Diego attorney who has won Public Records Act victories over the PUC, forcing the PUC to make public some emails from Governor Brown regarding the PUC corruption scandal. Aguirre states, Nancy McFadden's involvement while having a financial interest in PG&E shows that Wall Street's hold over utility regulators in California extends beyond the PUC to the governor's office. Neither the PUC nor the government appear to represent the interests of the ratepayers, he said. Emails between then-PUC Chair Michael Peavy and PG&E lobbyist Brian Cherry called McFadden the utility's, quote, backdoor route, unquote, and go-to person in the governor's office. McFadden had been PG&E's senior vice president of governmental affairs, and she left the company with $1 million in severance pay in addition to her stock. During the first weeks of the Brown administration in January 2011, in the wake of the PG&E deadly San Bruno gas pipeline explosion, emails released under the Public Records Act show that Cherry forwarded Peavey a PG&E roundup of a Wall Street downgrade of Edison International and PG&E stock from buy to hold recommendations. Cherry voiced concerns that investors feared two appointments made by the governor may have swung the commission too far in the consumer-oriented direction. The email exchange shows that Peavey, a former PG&E CEO, urged the PG&E lobbyists to contact McFadden in the governor's office and that they had discussions on potential appointments. Cherry said McFadden asked Peavey to recommend some names of commissioners. And in another email, Cherry, the lobbyist, suggested that commission appointments should be handled via a, quote, backdoor route, adding, "I'd be happy to do that with Nancy, but I'm not sure a letter would be advantageous to you given the mess around San Bruno et al. Your choice," unquote. The complaint also states that many pieces of legislation relating to PG&E were debated in the state in 2011 and 2012 while McFadden held stock in PG&E. Many would have affected the value of her stock. One decision was aimed at her personal economic interest. That bill, AB 861, would have required former utility executives like McFadden to return incentive pay in the wake of fines related to disasters like the San Bruno explosion. McFadden got a $1 million payout from PG&E as she left for the governor's office, according to SEC filings. Brown signed the legislation, but the provision related to requiring former executives like McFadden to return special compensation was amended out of the bill before he signed it. McFadden also failed to accurately account for her trades in PG&E stock as required by state law, concealing dates of her stock trades and their amount, which could reveal insider trading, Consumer Watchdog's complaint alleges. A press release from the Consumer Group states the inaccuracies and omissions prevent the public from knowing when she made her sales, which is critical given that she had inside information about the investigation into the San Bruno explosion, which had a material impact on a volatile stock. The complaint states the FPPC investigation of Ms. McFadden's role is vital to the public interest because it may have broader implications. A Superior Court judge in San Francisco has already determined that there was probable cause to believe that there were felonies committed involving one of the parties to the email communications above, Mr. Peavey. His home was the subject of a search warrant in which evidence was uncovered about an agreement to make ratepayers pay for the failed San Onofre nuclear power plant here in Southern California. Now, a spokesman for Governor Brown has disputed the allegations, the Los Angeles Times reports. Evan Westrup, a spokesman for the governor, stated, "Nancy did not play a role in the decisions you're asking about while she had those holdings." And he added, "This filing is riddled with inaccuracies and has no merit."
Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump on Sunday issued a warning to Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders. "Be careful, Bernie." The warning comes after Trump accused Sanders' campaign of organizing protests that shut down the Trump rally in Chicago on Friday. Trump tweeted a sinister warning on Sunday morning, which Sanders was asked about on CNN on Sunday. He had this to say in reply, "We should take Mr. Trump's words with a grain of salt, because I think, as almost everybody knows, this man cannot stop lying about anything. To talk about our organization or our campaign disrupting his meeting is a lie. Some of them were supporters of mine, but certainly, absolutely, our campaign had nothing to do with disrupting his meeting." Sanders went on to say that Trump is fostering an environment that encourages violent clashes. Trump blamed thugs who shut down our First Amendment rights for shutting down his rally on Friday, where fights broke out before Trump even took the podium. According to Chicago police, 5 people were arrested and 2 officers were injured. At a North Carolina Trump rally, a supporter was arrested for assault for punching a protester. Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton has joined Sanders in condemning the violence at Trump rallies. "I know that everybody in public life gets protested against, and sometimes people do need to be removed, but it should be done in an appropriate manner," Clinton said on MSNBC. "Other people in the audience should not be joining in. Mr. Trump should not be urging people on." These are not the only two instances of violence at Trump rallies. In October, a Latino protester was kicked and immigration activists were shoved and spit on. In November, a black protester was punched, kicked, and briefly choked. In February, East County Magazine reported that a Time Magazine photographer was slammed to the ground. Trump refused to fix the problem, calling Sanders and Clinton phony politicians on Twitter. "I have no objection to what I said," Trump said of past statements at his rallies. "I would say it again." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Liz Albert.
This is Leon Thompson with a health report. 5 cases of mumps have been diagnosed in students at the University of San Diego, the County Health and Human Services Agency reports. The first case was diagnosed in February. It is unknown where that student contracted the illness. The new cases are all close contacts of the first student diagnosed. Mumps is a highly contagious viral disease that can be prevented through vaccines. The county is working with USD to provide free vaccinations to all undergraduates at the university to prevent the outbreak from spreading. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county public health officer, says several colleges and universities across the country are having mumps outbreaks. She cautions spring break is going to bring an opportunity for this disease to spread, so students should be sure they are up to date with mumps and all other recommended vaccines. Mumps is spread by coughing, sneezing, or close contact with an infected person. Typical symptoms of mumps include fever, headache, earache, sore throat, and inflammation of the salivary glands, which results in swelling and tenderness along the jawline. Severe complications are rare but can include meningitis, decreased fertility, permanent hearing loss, and in extreme cases, miscarriage in pregnant women during the first trimester. There is no treatment for mumps. Most people recover without problems. The best way to prevent mumps is by getting the MMR vaccine. That's measles, mumps, and rubella. 2 doses of the vaccine are recommended, one at 12 to 15 months of age, and another at 4 to 6 years of age. A 3rd booster shot is often recommended during an outbreak. For more information about mumps, other vaccine-preventable diseases, and the vaccines that protect against them, contact the county's immunization program at www.sdiz.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Friday, March 18, 2016. I'm Mark Richardson. Topping today's newscast, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder is grilled on Capitol Hill over the Flint water crisis. Texas is embroiled in another voting rights controversy. And some military veterans find a drug-free way to ease their PTSD. Our lead story, it was a tough day on Capitol Hill for Michigan Governor Rick Snyder, who testified to a congressional panel about what he knew about the Flint water crisis and when he knew it. Snyder, who accepted limited responsibility for not dealing with the discovery of lead in the city's water supply, told a skeptical congressional panel Thursday that there was plenty of blame to go around, including the EPA. That didn't sit well with committee Democrats, who have suggested that Snyder, a Republican, should resign over his role in the matter. Maryland Representative Elijah Cummings laid the blame squarely at Snyder's feet.
"But Governor Snyder's administration caused this horrific disaster and poisoned the children of Flint. These children, when we're dead and gone, these children will suffer for what we failed to do."
EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy took heat from the committee Republicans, but said her agency was late in acting in Flint because it was misled by state officials. The presidential caravan heads for primaries in Arizona and Utah next week, with 98 delegates up for grabs on the Republican side and more than 120 for the Democrats. A GOP debate scheduled for Salt Lake City Monday night was canceled after Republican frontrunner Donald Trump announced he would not participate. All 4 candidates, including Trump, Ted Cruz, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders, have rallies scheduled in Arizona over the weekend. After Tuesday, the primary season slows down for a few weeks, with the next big prize coming April 19 with the New York primary. President Obama's Supreme Court nominee, Federal Appeals Judge Merrick Garland, got a frosty reception from Senate Republicans Thursday as he paid a visit to Capitol Hill. The GOP has vowed that it will not take any action on a nominee until the next president is elected. Texas is embroiled in another voting rights controversy. A public interest group has filed a lawsuit against the state of Texas for refusing to allow people to register to vote when they renew their driver's license online. The Texas Civil Rights Project claims that the Texas Department of Public Safety's website is difficult and confusing for people seeking to register online. Hani Mirza, an attorney for the project, says the state has received numerous complaints from people who were denied the opportunity to vote.
We've had almost 2,000 complaints from voters attempting to update their registration files when visiting the DPS website. And I think that's just a fraction of the issues people are having around the state.
Mirza says people who tried to register to vote when they updated their driver's licenses online often found they were turned away at the polls because the state system didn't send their information to local election bureaus. A bill working its way through the Colorado legislature could provide new protections for the state's young lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender populations. Eric Galatas has more.
A bill that would ban mental health professionals licensed in Colorado from engaging in so-called conversion therapy with a patient under age 18 is headed to the state Senate after clearing the House on Thursday. Laura Reinch with the group One Colorado praised the move and says the practice of trying to change a person's sexual orientation or gender identity has been widely discredited.
Every mainstream mental health and medical professional association has rejected the view as scientifically valid. They all advise that parents, guardians, young people, and their families avoid sexual orientation change efforts that portray homosexuality as a mental illness or a developmental disorder.
The bill's opponents claim the law would impact a family's ability to choose treatment.
The NCAA National Championship Tournament is underway, and while most everybody has a favorite team, for some communities, the tourney can bring notoriety and revenue. While Iowa, Iowa State, and the University of Northern Iowa traveled out of state to play in the tournament this year, some of the best-known teams in the country came to Des Moines for the first time. The Wells Fargo Arena in downtown Des Moines is hosting second and third round games in the tournament. Greg Edwards of the Greater Des Moines Convention and Visitors Bureau says landing the tournament was a decades-long process and followed by three failed bids by local organizers.
The NCAA kept telling us, you know, hey, we like Des Moines, we like the location, we like the affordability, the accessibility, you've got great hotels. But they kept saying, you know, there's so many other new arenas in the Midwest. The competition is just so strong.
In recent years, Des Moines has hosted women's basketball regional games as well as the national wrestling tournament. A group based in Maryland has trained more than 600 yoga instructors across the country to help former and current members of the military who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Veronica Carter reports.
The Department of Veterans Affairs says up to 20% of the 2.3 million American veterans who've returned from Iraq and Afghanistan suffer from PTSD at some point. Treatment is generally with prescription medications and psychotherapy. But the Journal of Traumatic Stress says yoga can be used to bring better mental health. Robin Carnes is the co-founder of Warriors at Ease, a training program for yoga instructors. She says although yoga can help those vets, it has to be done correctly on their level.
There are things that you can offer people in yoga and meditation that make their trauma symptoms worse. There's millions of yoga practices over thousands of years, and they're being created all the time.
Most of the training for Warriors at Ease is done online, and there are over 600 certified yoga instructors who can teach it to military members across the country and at American bases in other countries.
Carter reports that instructors often have trouble getting the soldiers to try yoga, but once they do, many say they feel better and that it does ease their stress. I'm Mark Richardson for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capitol Report. The House of Representatives has passed two measures aimed at holding ISIS and the Syrian regime accountable for atrocities committed in the Middle East. The first measure, House Concurrent Resolution 75, passed Congress unanimously with all five San Diego members voting in favor. It calls on President Obama to declare crimes perpetrated against Christians, Yazidis, and other religious minorities to be war crimes and crimes against humanity. Author Jeff Fortenberry, a Republican from Nebraska, has called ISIS a threat against civilization itself.
ISIS, also known as ISIL or the Islamic State, has been documented engaging in torture, beheadings, enslavement of children, and other atrocities. The second measure, House Concurrent Resolution 121, asks the president to direct his ambassador at the United Nations to promote establishment of a war crimes tribunal to prosecute war crimes committed by the government of Syria, its allies, and other parties to the conflict. This measure passed by a 392-3 vote. Among San Diego's delegation, Republicans Duncan Hunter and Daryl Issa voted for the measure, along with Democrats Susan Davis and Juan Vargas. Democrat Scott Peters was not present for the vote.
This is Ed Barreno with some memorable news. Researchers in Australia have been able to fully restore memory loss in 75% of mice with Alzheimer's using a pioneering new treatment. The technique uses ultrasound technology, a non-invasive procedure, to clear out neurotoxic amyloid plaques from the brain that cause memory loss in Alzheimer's patients. Sound waves opened up the blood-brain barrier for several hours, long enough to stimulate the brain's microglial cells to activate and clear out toxic beta-amyloid clumps responsible for the most devastating Alzheimer's symptoms. This groundbreaking research was done at the Queensland Brain Institute, affiliated with the University of Queensland. Results of the dramatic findings were published in Science Translational Medicine. The mice had no damage to surrounding brain tissue and performed normally on all memory tasks after the treatment. The treatment is affordable and holds promise to finally offer a cure for the devastating cognitive decline caused by Alzheimer's disease, which accounts for 60 to 80% of dementia cases, according to the Alzheimer's Association. Jürgen Getz, one of the researchers on the team, said in a press release, quote, "We're extremely excited by this innovation of treating Alzheimer's without using drug therapeutics. The word breakthrough is often misused, but in this case, I think this really does fundamentally change our understanding of how to treat this disease, and I foresee a great future for this approach," unquote. Next up, the team plans tests on larger animals, including sheep, and hope to launch human clinical trials starting next year.
The Elgahome Police Department seeks public help to find a hit-and-run driver who struck and seriously injured a 12-year-old girl Tuesday morning around 8:20 a.m. The child was crossing the street with friends on East Chase Avenue near Avocado when she was hit. She was not in the crosswalk and was crossing mid-block. The suspect vehicle was caught on surveillance video. Police describe it as a silver 2016 Honda Accord two-door car or a similar model. It was traveling east on Chase when the accident occurred. The driver did not stop, leaving the injured child in the street. El Cajon police officers and fire department paramedics responded to the scene. The victim was transported to a hospital with serious but non-life-threatening injuries. Her two friends were not injured, according to Lieutenant Randy Sillard. If you have any information on the location of the suspect vehicle or the identity of its owner or driver, please call the El Cajon Police Department Traffic Division at 619-441-1632. Or the Communication Center at 619-579-3311. The Elgahome Police Department has asked the media to remind pedestrians to always cross the street at controlled intersections equipped with traffic control devices and crosswalks. Elgahome has had many pedestrian injuries and deaths, many due to pedestrians not following traffic safety rules. El Cajon Police has established a pedestrian safety campaign with pedestrian safety tips that you can read by visiting elcajonpolice.org and clicking on Check Before You Step. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Liz Alpert.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County. This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Rebecca Grant, author of A Sticky Web of Vengeance, Memoirs of a Coach's Wife, the story of James and Rebecca Grant. My guest, who in her life has been both a victim and a victim's advocate, has struggled for years to uncover the truth about her husband's tragic death in 2007. Welcome, Rebecca. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Let's start with your relationship with your husband, James Grant, a head track coach from the University of Iowa. What was it about that relationship that changed you so much that the experience prompted you to write this memoir?
Well, it was surrounding around his, my husband was fighting with cancer for a few years before his death in 07. And during the last couple weeks of his death, my whole life was turned upside down. On July 5th, 2007, myself and a pastor, Reverend Dow from Bethel AME Church in Iowa City, Iowa, helped me to get my husband to the hospital where his memory was gone. He couldn't remember anything, the time, date, year. Wow. He was very combative, throwing water, pulling knives, throwing water at me, pulling knives, yelling, scared the kids. And that's because he had over 20-something tumors in his head.
Oh, how terrible.
And he was, several months, he's been fighting with mood change and his mental state, where he couldn't drive no more. He had to have 24-hour care. I bathed him. I showered him. He could do just a little, but not that much. I cooked his food, fed him. He was total dependent on me. Me and the kids that helped him 24/7, took him to all his doctor's appointments. I did everything with no help but the grace of God.
Okay, so that was when he came down with cancer and afterwards. And before that, what was your relationship like? Because I know that's a significant part of the memoir as well.
We had an outstanding relationship. We had, I would call it puppy love. At first, I met, he was much older than me. And I fought the relationship because he was older than me. And he didn't look at age, but I did. Where I tried to hook him up with a few friends of mine I knew and set those dates up. And you can read all about that in my book. But he was very persuasive. I mean, he even followed me, came to my church and showed up. He was not going to stop until he got me. And I eventually gave in. And we had a love life and a love story that was remarkable. And those are things that I'll never forget to this day.
Remarkable in what way?
We traveled to different places out through United States and also back to his hometown, Jamaica, because he was Jamaican. And just little things that he would have set up if it wasn't a private dinner or a little of walks in the park or just little outings, and it was always beautiful with passionate love that took place, you know, during our rendezvous, I would call them. But he was always full of surprises, and that's what made our relationship great. Not only was he full of surprises, but he was such a kind and gentle man and a good father to my children. And they would never forget him as well as I wouldn't either.
Now, I know that there were some conflicts with his children. Is that correct?
That's correct. That was later. From day one, for some reason, now they didn't live. He had three daughters live in the New York area. And one son that was Harlem, which he didn't really give me any problem. They had one son that lived in Iowa City. But the crazy part is, I dated him for about 3 or 4 years before I even knew he had any kids.
Oh, wow.
I mean, been to his condo, no pictures, no nothing. I never knew he had any kids until his son, Jamie, came to stay with him. And at the time, he told me it was his nephew, so I never knew it was his son. Until one day, me and Jamie was talking, and I was asking him, did he have any other siblings? And he said, no, he was his dad's only child, But his dad had other kids. I'm like, okay, so your dad had other kids? And he said, yeah, my dad, Jimmy. We called James Jimmy for, you know, short. And I was shocked. And I left the house and read the book. The book could tell you more what happened. But I was surprised. I did not know it. And when I did push to issue numerous of times to meet his kids, he was hesitant. When I finally got to meet him. And they just didn't like me from day one. They had a problem with my age. They had a problem with my skin complexion. And they had a problem because I was American. They were Jamaican kids. Their mothers were all Jamaican mothers, and that's what they want their father with. But the crazy thing about it, My husband had 5 kids by 5 different women, which I didn't know that until later on. He never signed a birth certificate for any of them. Now, he was married to Aisha's mother, and the rest of the kids were like, he was a track star in Jamaica, kind of where you hear the basketball players over here. Mm-hmm. They're kind of out there sowing their rural oats, and they're with this woman and that woman. And, you know, Suzette, he didn't meet till she was like 8 or 10 years old. And he said he always had his suspicion, were they really his kids? Back then, you know, DNA wasn't a big thing, especially not in Jamaica, in a third world country.
Right.
So he was able to get Jamie tested probably about a year before he died. It came back in 90-something. But he still said that Jamie wasn't his. It was his brother's son, because his brother also dated Jamie's mother after my husband did. So, I mean, I'm not saying that's a Jamaican culture, because it's probably not. It's just something that they did.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that was something that you accepted and moved forward with the relationship. I mean, it sounds like you had a good marriage overall, and despite these sort of hidden aspects of his life before he met you.
Well, yes, we had a good marriage, and what I had to do, I had to pray on it, because I come from a very spiritual family.
Mm-hmm.
I prayed on it. A few months, I would not talk to him, have anything to do with him. We got back together, and he promised he would never keep anything from me again, which he did before he died. You know, that's when I found out that I thought I was like this, you know, second wife, but actually, I was actually the fourth wife. So, you know, a lot of things I learned, and he started coming out telling me things. But, you know, I thank him that he did, you know, before he died, he did get things straight, and mm-hmm. he opened up to me. And the reason why he said he kept a lot of those things hidden, he started a new life in Iowa, especially at a Big Ten school, University of Iowa. He didn't want people to look down on him that he had, you know.
Right, sure.
Multiple kids by multiple women.
Yeah.
And he wasn't for sure if those was his kids. But he never denied them.
Mm-hmm.
He just, you know, in back of his mind, did not know if they were his. He was unsure about that. And he loved each and every one of them. But they had a very strange relationship with him. My understanding, none of them never came to visit Iowa until a couple months before he died. They all showed up. Now, Suzette did used to live in Iowa with Jimmy. When he first came to Iowa, he sent back for his ex-wife, Janet, and Suzette, and Janet's daughter came. And I don't know the reason why, because Suzette's mother died of cancer, and then he took Suzette to his mother, and she helped raise her, but Suzette was too much for the mother, so he brought Suzette to the States. And he always said that Suzette hated him for that, because she wanted to stay in Jamaica. But the 2 years that my husband fought cancer, and the 2 years that I took care of him, not one of his kids, ex-wife, anybody showed up to help.
Yeah,
until the last days, they all showed up with their hands out.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So he died in 2007, and then in 2008, you became involved in a lawsuit with the University of Iowa, sort of fighting for your rights as his wife. Talk about that lawsuit and your battle for justice.
Yes, that was a very trying time. In 2007, I need to go back and say what happened. I was sick 3 days while my husband was in the hospital. We took him to the hospital July 5th. I was there the 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th. I was absent from the hospital. I had a fever. My body was just wore down.
Sure.
From taking care of my husband. I mm-hmm. did everything. And his nights and days were mixed up, where he would roam at night, and I was pretty much during the night, especially I having 3 small kids at the home, and the girls were probably about 7 and 8 at the time, and mm-hmm. my baby boy was probably about 13. So it was kind of hard. And you have to watch them at all times, because I know one time we woke up during the middle of the night and we were always choking and coughing, and that was nobody but God that woke us up, where he was sitting in the garage. The garage is attached to the house, and he had started the car, and smoke was all, fumes all in the house.
Oh.
And a few times, you know, you woke up where he had a burner on the stove, turning the burner. So you had to watch him like watching a child.
Right.
And by me, used to be in the medical field. I was a CNA and also worked in labs. So I knew what I was doing. I knew how to take care of him. And I knew it was the illness. So I was not going to place my husband in no type of home because I promised him that when it came to him getting where he can do for himself, I would take care of him and be by his side until the end. So those days I was absent from the hospital, my whole life was turned upside down. Me and the pastor, we took Jimmy to the hospital. The doctors them took him down to x-ray and told us that he had a blood clot that has traveled to the brain. So he had less than a few weeks, maybe a month to live. So they told us to prepare ourselves. I had them put a note on the door. Me and Pastor Dow decided that where, you know, if anyone come to visit, they need to check with the nurse station. My husband was a very private man, and he told me he did not want anyone to know he was dying or in the hospital. Even the University of Iowa Athletic Department did not know how bad his cancer was.
Because that's a lot to hide.
He wanted to keep his job up to the day he died.
Mm-hmm.
The coaches would come by the house. He would give them orders and stuff, but he was very weak. He cried a lot. He was a mess.
Sounds like he loved his job and didn't want to let go of it.
Well, he loved his job, but one thing about it, Paula Jantz came to our house, his boss, and she tried to get him to up his job. And, you know, then he figured that Lane Anderson, the one that took his place now, was kind of snooping around, wanted his job. And he just didn't, you know, he didn't want it. He needed his benefits, especially with the cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And he did not want to get rid of the job. And there was a nice lady in the community, Iowa City, Marion Coleman, was putting something together so they could still have him within the athletic department instead of trying to take his job away from him. And that's the reason why he did not want them to know how bad he was. My husband had brain cancer, lung cancer, and the cancer metastasized out through his whole body, where the cancer he's seen came out of his pores. You can see marks on his face and different things.
So when you sued the University of Iowa, what was that about?
Well, like I said, during those times I was at a home sick. Dr. Clayman was my husband's oncology doctor. He brought in Dr. Michelle T. Wickman, a psychiatrist, to look at my husband's mental state because I told you the mm-hmm. things he was doing. She took upon herself and pushed my husband's oncology doctor out of his care, along with the other oncology doctors. And this lady knew nothing about my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And I put my husband at the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics under John Doe. It was leaked that my husband was there. Also, my husband's daughters was called around looking for him, told them that he was in the hospital. And that's a HIPAA violation, but they did that and got away with it. So during the process, what they did was they took and used my husband. Jamie found out he was up there, my husband's son. So I told Jamie, that's okay. Just stay here. My husband was having problems with Jamie. He was being rebellious when my husband wanted him to go back to Jamaica. And my husband didn't have a close relationship with the kids. None did he have a close relationship with his staff. He was a very private man. And we kept everything to ourselves. I want to say March, we went to pick out his casket because we knew what was going on. We went to Lincent's funeral, picked out his casket with a good friend of ours that came along. And we had everything set for his body to go back to Jamaica, the funeral. We planned everything together. Well, these people came in with the help of Michelle T. Wickman. And for some reason, they had my husband think that our house wasn't a safe place for him to go back to. They also act like I abandoned him up there. And remind you, my husband's mind was gone, shot.
Right.
You know, he couldn't think for himself. So they did all these things. Then I found out that they called his ex-wife, Janet Richardson, to come from Florida. Now, remind you, she didn't have any kids by him. But this same woman showed up at our house in March of 2007 with her daughter and her niece. And wanted to know about his health and things like that. Well, during the process, she brought a bag with some sweaters and it said it was from, you know, her daughter and her niece. Well, as I was going through the things, there was a ring in there and a card where she was very upset that he married me and bought me a house and a ring, and she wanted him back. And that ring was a part of the topic in the courtroom. But those are things that these people did to me. Not only that, the girl showed up in May of 2007, my husband's three kids, never came any of those other times. They wanted to know if they were in the will and what was he leaving him.
Right.
And they would call constantly that he stopped taking their calls. What was he leaving them? I mean, it was just, I never seen anything like that in my life, and where he just didn't want to have anything to do with them. But to go back to the hospital, I found out on, I went back and see my husband on July 10th, and I noticed the nurse's station, they were acting kind of funny, kept peeking in with me and my daughters, them, was at the hospital. My husband said, oh, you ready to take me home? You know, he talked like a child. I said, oh, yes, you know, we're going to be taking you home tomorrow when they release you. Well, I get a phone call early the morning of July 11th, was asking if I could come to a meeting at the hospital later on that afternoon. Well, when I got to the hospital, the strangest thing I seen was this ex-wife was in my husband's room. But what I seen was a purse by the bed. And later on, I found it was her, which the book will tell more about that. This Dr. Wickman set up a meeting to decide where Jimmy should go. And as I was walking down with Jimmy to the room where they were going to have the meeting, I seen a little yellow sticky on his planner that I took up there on July 10th. And I took his cell phone that same day. On the sticky, number one, it says divorce, Becky. My nickname's Becky. Number two, Janet, Door Power Attorney. Number three, Greg Fender, Executor. And I'm like, what is this about? And I said, what is that about? I said, Jimmy, what is that? He said, I don't know. I don't know where that came from. So as we got in the meeting, he sat there and I sat on the other side, and then his son Jamie sat by him. And first thing he did, you know, the Dr. Wickman and also Dr. Bird was at the meeting, and Iowa City Hospital, a few from Iowa City Hospitals and another nurse from the University of Iowa. And then I looked in the meeting. Here was Greg Fender, showed up a little bit later. There was Victor Houston. He was the assistant coach at Iowa, track coach under my husband. There was Jamie Grant, his son. There was Janet Richardson and the other staff that I mentioned earlier. And like I said, Greg came later. And I'm like, what is going on? Because remind you, me and my husband did everything private. It just always been us.
So your privacy was disrespected and invaded, and then all kinds of boundary invasions, like with exes and basically not respecting the sanctity of your relationship and your taking care of him. And then also what you inherited afterwards. So how did that lawsuit resolve?
Well, what happened was after the meeting, this Wickman decided for him to go to, the assistant coach's house, and I was very upset about it. So I started right. I would call pastor, told him what happened. He couldn't believe it. And he had a deacon from the church, Melvin Shaw, to represent me because everything happened so fast. The next day I got up real just upset and crying, like, you know, why are they taking my husband from me? I go to the courthouse, and me and my daughter and them, and I told him, you know, what happened. I said, you know, I told the judge he was being combative, why he ended up at the hospital. He lost his mind, this and that. Well, they gave me the wrong document, and it was a restraining order to keep my husband away from me. And Melvin Shaw said, oh, that's the wrong document. We have to get that off. So we wouldn't end up getting that off three or four days later, but he ended up going to Victor's house. And during the process while he was at Victor's house, listen to this. He got out on July 13, 2007 from the hospital. The same day he got out of the hospital, his daughter Suzette flew in from New York. Suzette, along with Victor Houston, Greg Fender, and they had attorney. I found out why the days I was sick at home, named Joseph T. Moreland, came to the hospital where they found an attorney for my husband. They had him redo his will. They pushed him to the attorney's office in a wheelchair to redo his will. And that's where the battle started when it came to court. Now, remind you, my husband had everything planned. His accountant, Michael, from New York, came in. And then my husband started making several different wills and where he wanted his assets to go. He didn't leave kids anything. He didn't leave nothing. And I tell people, my husband wasn't a rich man. He was just a track coach. Track coaches don't make that much. He just wanted to make sure the house was paid off that
right.
We
people
inherited
cared for his family.
And that we had enough to take care of whatever.
Sure.
But that all changed, and that's where the battle of the will came in at. And 2008 was the will contested, and it was horrible. It was put together, the daughters them lied, the attorneys that was involved, they lied. My husband left me insurance policies and had left everything to my name, and he was supposed to tell me where to take them. I didn't know where to take them. So ended up, my first attorney was Julia Mears. My second attorney was Julia Mears. Julia Mears told me to take them and drop these documents off at the university benefit office and TRA Crafts in Iowa City. I did that. Well, they told me I didn't have a rights as his wife to even drop those off. But I'll remind you, I was his wife. I did everything. A lot of things that they did at that hospital was against HIPAA violation. They took me out like right. I was not his wife. I was my husband's dual power attorney. Even the medical documents, my husband signed, do not share no information with no one but his wife and himself. Michelle T. Wickman, Dr. Berg, Dr. Klayman, and a University of Iowa staff violated that, and Iowa City Hospital violated his rights as well as our rights.
Right, which is a huge violation, especially in today's age where we're so concerned about HIPAA and privacy.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Without spoiling the book, I know that you took it up to the Supreme Court, so we'll let the readers see what became right. of that. But I know that you sort of segued into becoming a political activist, and you advocate for others. You feel like you've been victimized in several ways. And in addition to the lawsuit, you're fighting for other people in other aspects of your life, that now you help kids fight against racism and bullying, as well as your political activity. So tell us about that. How did your experiences with your husband and the fight against the university lead you to where you are today?
After I sat there numb during that whole process, grieving my husband and then taking his body back to Jamaica, sent his body back to Jamaica in 2007, and how to weigh, I was even, you know, threatened in Jamaica by his kids. And then coming back that following year and going through court and sat there and still did not realize what happened, dealing with depression and just in shock. And as I remember looking around that courtroom and remembering the jurors sleeping and holding their hands up, didn't want to be there. And I thank God for Dr. Andrews. Dr. Andrews was his oncology doctor. I never forget when he stood up and he said, it's a shame that you people took advantage of a dying man. This man should not have been signing any documents. But one thing about it, what was so unfair, the judge had a lot of stuff blotted out. And that's where I have problem with our justice system. Okay. A lot of things that the jurors would have been able to see was blotted out. And I think our justice system here in America needs to be changed, because you have a lot of people on death row, in prison, or in the grave because of things that the judge blotted out. I think everything should be always shown within the court, everything.
Transparency.
Yeah, because you always hear jurors say after later, well, I didn't know that because we couldn't see it. So we end up losing the will contest. They're going to say that they believe my husband was in his right mind to change his will, because Dr. Wickman said that she did a test on him. Well, later on, I found out, reading the documents this past year, even more, that she never did a test on him. Not only that, through some of the few of the doctors at the University of Iowa that worked there, also said she did not do a test on him. But she lied on a witness stand, lied in documents, that she did a mental test on my husband to see his mental status.
So your motivation is to see justice be done in many places as you can.
My motivation is, after going through depression all these years and angry because of what happened to me, then I go back and look at, you know, being in an abusive relationship. And I said, you know, I need to fight back. I need to stop letting people walk all over me. So I started fighting back. I fight for children's rights. I fight for, if you're wrongdoing, I'm going to fight for you. And I'm fighting to bring this story to life so this will not happen to anyone else, especially when Big Ten universities always seem to push stuff up underneath the rug if you go back to Penn State. And then you look at the University of Iowa, where they knew and they got away with a lot of stuff that happened, even from documents being stolen at my husband's office, and also the Postal Service under Ron Jewell, that they stole my mail, went through my mail. Postal Service did nothing. Because you know why? They did not want the university to be in the spotlight. So that's why I fight for justice. And I'm going to continue to fight and continue until the day I die to help anyone I can.
And to tell your story.
And tell my
Great.
Story. Yes.
I have one last question then. Is there another book in the works, or is this it?
Well, there is another book in the works. And there's a spinoff from this, because a lot of things that I just found out recently, I'm going to do a spinoff. And not only that, people wanted to know what happened to the author.
So there'll be a sequel.
So it'll be a sequel.
Okay.
So they'll know what happened to the author and when she woke up and when she started fighting.
And when will we see that? What year do you think?
You will see that book should be coming out early part of 2017.
Great.
And Raina, I just want to say they can also buy the book at Barnes & Noble. It's also on Amazon and also CreateSpace. And also, it's in local libraries out through the world. So if they want to get that book, there's a lot of different places they could get that book.
That's all we have time for now, but thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me once again.
For more information on Rebecca Grant and her work, please visit her website at rg7bookpublishing.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
Saving water is a good thing. It should never come back to bite you. But there can be unintended consequences. So if you decided this El Nino season to buy or make a rain barrel to conserve water, fight the drought, and cut your water bills, make sure it doesn't become a place for mosquitoes to breed. That can happen if you don't make sure your rain barrel is properly screened to keep mosquitoes out so they can't lay eggs inside, or if your barrel has areas on it where water pools up outside the barrel, such as on the top. Officials from the County Department of Environmental Health's Vector Control Program said they have found poorly sealed and homemade rain barrels infested with mosquitoes that can transmit diseases to people. Chris Conlon with the county's Vector Control Program says, quote, "When you start saving water in containers, you've now provided prime breeding grounds for mosquitoes, and people forget that even if it hasn't rained, you can still have condensation on your roof from fog, which will trickle down the gutter and fill the barrel a little," unquote. Mosquitoes, from our native species that can carry West Nile virus to recently discovered invasive Aedes species like the yellow fever mosquito and Asian tiger mosquito, only need tiny amounts of water to breed and create new mosquitoes. Getting bitten by a mosquito does not necessarily mean you'll be exposed to illness. Mosquitoes typically are not born carrying disease. Native mosquitoes can become West Nile vectors by feeding on infected birds. And San Diego County is not home to the diseases that have been linked to Aedes mosquitoes, the Zika virus, yellow fever, and chikungunya, although people who have traveled to parts of the world with those diseases have returned home with the disease. But getting bitten by mosquitoes is always annoying, so here are a few steps people can take to keep their rain barrels safe. It's always best to use a container that has been specifically created to be a rain barrel and that is designed to keep bugs and debris out. Use mosquito-proof screen, the same kind of mesh you can find on your window screens, to seal openings that could allow mosquitoes into your rain barrel. Keep barrel lids and connectors sealed tight to keep out bugs, and be sure to check gutters that flow into the rain barrel. Regularly inspect your rain barrel to get rid of any water that could pool up on the outside and create a place where mosquitoes can breed. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Kevin McLeod, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, Please contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.